The first lecture yesterday was the most theoretical all of them. I tried to give you an idea of some of the math behind, some of the physics behind how interferometers work. Then this morning, we moved a little bit closer to the experimental side just by discussing, at the end of the day, the thing that most of us experimentalists spend our life discussing about, which is noise. And we discuss seismic noise, thermal noise, and quantum noise, which are the three main contributions to the fundamental limitation to the sensitivity of the detector. What I want to do today, well, in this last lecture, is to go even more into the dirty details of the experiment. So there will be two parts. The first part is really basically trying to convince you why it's hard to make those detectors work, why you just design to the best of your knowledge, you build it, and it just doesn't work. And then you have to spend a lot of time to figure out why it doesn't work. And this is what we call, in a technical term, commissioning, which basically means you look at your detector, you look very intensely at your detector, at the data, and you try to figure out what are the noise sources that are not fundamental, that you haven't considered in the design, and that are actually limiting your detector. Then in the second part of the lecture, I'm going to give you an idea of what's the current status of the gravitational wave detectors and where we are going in the near and not so near future. So let's get started with the technical noise sources. So I showed you this graph many, many times, and by now you should understand what we have. So this is, as a function of frequency, a measurement or an estimate of what kind of displacement noise you can get. So how small a displacement you can measure. And again, let me walk through this one more time. The black curve is the design sensitivity. So given the best knowledge we have to the detector and how we design it, what should be the fundamental limitation? And we saw that, oh, I lost my big pointer. Well, doesn't matter, I'm gonna.
Oh. It was being used as a paperweight.
Oh yeah, here, up here, all right. Oh, I see. This works as a multiple tool.
Yes.
Right. So, and we saw this morning that the design sensitivity is basically limited by three main contributions. Quantum noise, this purple curve, thermal noise in the coatings, the thick red curve, and different kinds of seismic noise and other thermal noises. Well, then I told you that this gray curve is the best sensitivity that the Livingstone detector, just to pick one, had so far. Well, it's quite clear that there's a little bit of difference here, right? That's not quite the same thing. So why is that? That's because we have a lot of noise sources and limitation detectors that are not yet completely solved, issues that are not completely solved, or some noises that are not completely understood. Actually, if we do the same exercise of putting together all the possible noises that we can think of, these pictures look more like this. So, wow, what is that? Well, I'm not going to walk through all of this. But again, the important thing is that we have frequency here, at the same kind of displacement sensitivity. You can see somewhere hidden below everything here, you see the design sensitivity. And then you see this red curve, which is a typical measured sensitivity from the LIGO-Hanford detector in a particular time during the O2 run. All the other curves here, each one represents a noise source that is not necessarily a fundamental noise source, but some sort of noise source. All of them, all that we could think of. And the black curve is the sum of all that we understand. So you can see two things here. First, the sum of all the noises we understand is way larger than the design sensitivity. Good, means that we know how to improve some of that part. But you also see that the actual measure sensitivity is larger than the sum of all the noises that we understand. What that means is that there's something we don't understand quite yet. So I'm not going to be able to tell you what we don't understand because, by definition, we don't know what is that. So a lot of work and what I'm going to do next week, starting next week when I'm back at the Hanford detector, is try to understand where that difference is. Yes?
There is at least two huge peaks.
Yes.
Well, wouldn't that, like, naively be more easy to understand?
All right. So, good question. So, these huge peaks are calibration lines. We add them on purpose. They're very well controlled forces applied to the mirror. So we always know what is the amplitude. We always know that those things must line up exactly there. If they don't, something is not quite working in our output reconstruction. Some of the others, like I think 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 60 hertz, it's the main lines. So the 60 hertz of the power supply. So you can get rid of that just to some extent because that's everywhere. It's the biggest, if you have any electromagnetic sensor of any kind, that's the biggest line because everything is radiating at that frequency. So it's kind of hard to get rid of them. But actually we can monitor the mains and subtract that in real time. But we don't do always it in this grot. Another important thing is that remember that gravitational waves are not monochromatic, but they sweep over multiple frequencies. So at the end of the day, even though this looks really horrible, the amount of time the chirp of gravitational wave signal will spend at that frequency beam is very small. So this huge peak contribute to a loss of sensitivity, which is much smaller than this bump here. Although the amplitude of that bump is smaller, it has a way, way larger frequency bandwidth. So the time that your signal stays there is longer, so you lose more there. I think that was a very good question. The idea of this lecture is to give you, some of those highlights. So I won't be able to go through all of these noises, and I know you're happy that I'm not going to do that, but let me just walk through a few of them just to give you an example of some of the noises that we have to work with. Yes?
If you did that plot for Hanford and for
Livingstone?
Yeah, are they the same?
They're different.
And do you understand why?
Partially. So the two detectors are nominally equal in the sense that on paper they've built exactly the same. Practically, they have been built exactly the same, but then the team of people that work on them are different. And when you put people in interaction with your detector, the things diverge. So every time you have a problem, the two teams kind of solve it in a different way. So that's why the two sensitivities are not quite the same, and they have different problems because they are nominally equal, but not quite.
So you're showing us Hanford when you show us.
I showed you, here we have Livingstone. Here I'm showing Hanford. Sometimes I'm going to show Livingstone. I'm going to show a few of them. I have a couple of plots from Virgo too, just to give you an idea. But yeah, they're different.
And the spikes, the eigenmodes, are they in the same place?
Or? More or less, yes. Of course, you can tune the eigenmodes of the fibers and the mirrors just to few hertz accuracy. Then they are more or less the same position, but not exactly to the millihertz, of course. Because they change with temperature too, so. So here is a list of some noises, just to give you an idea of the kind of disturbance and kind of problems we encounter in the day-to-day life of an experimentalist at the LIGO sites. So let me start from feedback control noise. If you remember, we discussed this morning how feedback works. So the idea again is that we start with some variable we want to control. Then we have a sensor, our interferometer, plus, for example, a photodiode that provides us an error signal. Then this error signal is noisy. Nothing is perfect. So what we actually measure is a noisy error signal. We develop some sort of linear feedback controller that will feed some force back, for example, to one of the mirror to keep this variable under control. And we already discussed this morning that the best you can do is to squeeze down this motion down to the sensing noise. So first of all, you want your sensor to be as good as possible. The problem is that you have a lot of degrees of freedom because think of just the longitudinal motion. We have two Fabry-Perot cavities, and the two lengths must be controlled within 10 to the minus 15 meters, RMS. So there are 2 degrees of freedom. Only the difference of the two is the one relevant for gravitational waves. The other is not. Then you have more mirrors, the power cycling mirror, the beam splitter, the signal cycling mirror. All of them need to be controlled and kept such that you have the right resonant condition. On top of that, for each mirror, add 2 angular controls. On top of that, add the laser frequency, add the laser power, add the pointing of the laser. It's easy to count something on the order of 100 degrees of freedom that need to be controlled. Each one can be controlled at best to the sensing noise. Well, one would say, well, who cares? At the end of the day, there's only 1 degree of freedom that's important, which is the differential motion of the two arms, because that's the gravitational wave signal. So in an ideal world, what you have is something like this. Here I have my main gravitational wave signal, which I called H, just to remember that it has something to do with a strain amplitude. And then, of course, I have to control that. But what happens here is not that important, because I can read out the motion here. I can read that, read out all the points. And then I can use some real-time reconstruction to just get rid of the fact that I have a loop. In an ideal world, I have, for example, the length of the power recycling cavity, just to pick one, that is an auxiliary degrees of freedom that I have to control again. This might be noisy, but who cares? The problem is that in the real world, there are cross-coupling between the loops. So what happens is that if you have, for example, a residual motion of the power recycling cavity, which is this A here, some residual motion, what happens is that this couples, for example, to the signal you use to read out the gravitational wave. So the signal you use to read out the gravitational wave is mostly sensitive to gravitational wave signal, but to a small extent also to the other degrees of freedom. And so you see that if you make this loop, this degrees of freedom, too noisy, that will give you some limitation and that will spoil your sensitivity. Or another possibility that can happen is that you are applying a force to the power cycling mirror, but that actuation is only in theory orthogonal to all the other actuation. So by applying a force there, you are actually also moving a little bit your differential degrees of freedom. The example of the power cycling cavity is not the case, because you are pushing one mirror and you're not pushing on the other mirrors. But for example, you have to control the differential and common mode of the two arms cavity. You can imagine that if when you actuate on the common mode, there's a little bit of leakage to the differential mode, because you can balance those two forces just to some finite accuracy, like everything. So all of this is just saying that when you control some auxiliary degrees of freedom, all of them, there is always some finite leakage of that control noise into the detector. And this is what, at the end of the day, ends up in the sensitivity. Now again, it's a similar plot as before, what we call the noise budget, in this case for Livingstone. So you will recognize that the plots are a little bit different. And then if you look at that, you're gonna see that we have this thing called Mitch, this thing called circle, and then, for example, we have, let's see, OMC length and other actuation. Those are all contribution that comes from some of the control loops. If you look here, you will see that for example, the angular control contributes somewhere at this level. And some of the longitudinal control contribute more or less to this level. So you see, for example, during O2, the last science run, the low frequency sensitivity below probably 20 or 30 hertz of the Livingstone detector was limited by our actuation in the angles. So that's one of the things that we worked a lot to improve in between the last run and during the stop. And we know that we're going to work on that to improve the sensitivity at low frequency. This is just one example. Let's move on. We have to use lasers. Our lasers are very stable, yes, but let's, for example, look at the power, the intensity noise of the laser. The laser produced 70 watts, for example. At the end, we used only 25 watts. Then the laser goes into your interferometer, and to read out the gravitational wave signal, we just pick off a small part at the antisymmetric part, and we have something of the order of typically, let's say, 10 milliwatts. So if you plug that number into the equation that I gave yesterday, you can find that the response of your system, so the optical gain of the interferometer, is more or less 4×10⁻⁹ watts per meter. So if the differential motion is 1 meter, which is huge, you would have a variation of 4×10⁻⁹ watts at the dark part. Of course, the variation is 10⁻⁹ meters, and so you get much smaller than that. So let's say that we want a displacement of the order of 10⁻⁸ meters. That's the kind of displacement. So if you multiply by that gain, it means that the variation of power is in the order of 10⁻⁹ times 4×10⁻⁹. And this gives you something in the order of 4×10⁻⁹ watts. This is the power variation due to a gravitational wave signal. By the way, 10⁻⁸ would be pretty large, right? Well, then the power that we have there is 10 milliwatts. So the relative intensity noise, delta P over P, is just this 4×10⁻⁹ divided 10 to the minus 2. So it's something of the order of 4 10 to the minus 7. This is just telling you that if you want to avoid your laser frequency to spoil the sensitivity of your detector, even for a gravitational wave, which is huge, you need the relative stability of the laser to be in the order of 10 to the minus 7. Actually, remember, you want to have at least some margin there. If you want an SNR of 10, it means that your power noise must be 10 times lower than that. And you get to levels of 10 to the minus 8 in relative stability at the intensity of the laser. There is no laser in the world that can reach that just out of the box. So how do you do that? Well, the way you do that is that you have to take a peak off of the laser, take a little bit here, sense it with a photodiode, and then close a feedback loop. So you actually take a little bit of the laser, you measure the prior fluctuation with a photodetector, and then you feedback to correct the laser. Again, you will be limited by the sensing noise of that photodiode. And what we can do is to just send enough power on a photodiode to be shot noise limited and reach the 10 to the minus 9 level of relative power stability. To do that, we have to pick off a significant amount of the power, or the order of 100 milliwatts. You cannot send 100 milliwatts on a single photodiode, or you're going to burn it. So that power is split into 8 photodiodes. So in vacuum, we have an array of 8 photodiodes that sense the input power and continuously use that to feedback. That, in that way, you can actually get to the level of intensity noise that is required to get the sensitivity you need. So this is a problem which has been already solved at the design time. It turned out that it's working. Sometimes, but when you design things properly, they even work, which is surprising. Of course, lasers are characterized not only by power, but also by frequency. So here, if you remember, when you have a wave propagating, we wrote that it's an intensity that goes like, the phase propagation of a plane wave over a distance is something like this. So here, this term KL is actually, you can write like omega naught over C times some L0 plus delta L. Well, this omega naught is the main frequency of the laser. This delta L is a small fluctuation due to the gravitational wave, and that L0 is just 4 kilometers long. So if you have some frequency noise, this becomes some omega naught plus delta omega divided by C times L0 plus delta L. So you see here that if you have a variation of the laser frequency, this pretty much gives you the same kind of dephasing that you would get by a change in length. And actually, the term here, you see that you have a term which is delta omega L0 over C, and another term which is just omega naught delta L over C. So at the end of the day, what you find out is that there is a relation like this. So any fluctuation of the laser, and here I should have wrote a omega naught, just to be consistent with my previous notation. So any fluctuation of the laser will produce a signal which is completely undistinguishable from a gravitational wave with a proportionality relation like that. So that's not good. That's why you need to stabilize the frequency of the laser. How do you stabilize the frequency of the laser? Well, the best way you can do that is to just have the laser and stabilize the frequency to a reference, which is given by a very precisely measured length. If you have a resonant cavity with a very precise length, you can have the laser frequency resonate. Then what happens is that the resonance condition will tell you what is the relative error between the frequency and the length, right? But then if the length is very stable, then whatever fluctuation you see in your error signal is due to the laser. So people that do metrology and high-precision measurement stabilize typically lasers to small, rigid reference cavities. We have reference cavities too, but what is the best, most stable cavity we can use to stabilize the laser? Well, it's the arm themselves. So we can just take the average, the common mode of the two Fabry-Perot cavities, which are 4 kilometers long. The mirror are suspended and they basically don't move at all. That's the best reference to stabilize the laser. By doing this, we can stabilize our lasers to a level such that the line width, delta F, is something of the order of 10 to the minus 3 hertz. Remember that the main frequency is something like 3 10 to the 14 hertz, because the wavelength is about 1 micron. So this gives you a relative stability which is in the 10 to the minus 17. which is the most stable laser ever realized on these time scales, of course. But again, seems like a very small number, but when you're in the gravitational waves business, everything is really small. So that's why, that's another example of things that we knew from the beginning. This frequency stabilization was designed and worked as expected. So this is good. Sometimes, again, good design pays off. Well, but a laser beam, so far we treated this as a plane wave. Well, you've seen laser pointers. I don't have any here, but I don't need, really need it. But lasers are beams. Actually, if you do the proper math, you can find out that a good beam with a Gaussian profile is diffraction limited, meaning that you can have a sun. If you take any cross-section of a laser beam propagating along this direction, the intensity distribution behaves like a Gaussian envelope. And then when this beam propagates, so let's say that the minimum size is here, when it propagates away, the size of the Gaussian is spread. So actually the envelope is some sort of hyperbola. This is just diffraction. You cannot win over diffraction. Actually, a Gaussian beam is the best you can do. So if you really want something that stays as confined as possible, the Gaussian beam is the best you can do. It's something you can get as a sort of Heisenberg uncertainty principle for the wave propagation in classical electromagnetism. So I will represent my beam with a sort of envelope like that. And you know, the fact that the beam spreads out also means that the wavefront, so the surfaces where the phase of the beam is a constant, is no more flat. It's flat only here at the beam waist. And then it gets curved. This is one reason we need to use curved mirrors in LIGO. So our mirrors are not flat. They have a curvature of about 2 kilometers. You would say, well, that's pretty flat. Sure, it's pretty flat, but it must be 2 kilometers within half a meter or so. Otherwise, the properties of the cavity will not match very well the property of the beam. And you can clearly see that once you choose the curvature of this mirror and the curvature of this mirror and the distance, there is only one possible shape of the beam which will resonate away. If the beam diverges a little bit too much, then when it's reflected back, it will diverge even more. And then since the beam resonates, it's going around the multiple bounces, pretty soon the shape becomes so large that you cannot build constructive interference anymore. Another way to say that the eigenmode of the cavity is very well defined by the radius of curvature and the size. This means that once we build our cavities, they have to be as equal as possible. It also means that the laser beam we send in must have the right shape. The input beam must be well overlapped with the eigenmode of the cavity. If that doesn't happen, so this is an example. So the beam out of the mirror will keep diverging, continuing on the same mode. So this is the ideal case. But of course, laser beams are physical objects like everything else. So you can get there, you can get close to that, but not quite exactly the right size. So there's a lot of different ways you can miss it. So you can have that, you go from perfect matching, you can have that the input beam is a little bit tilted. You can probably see that the axis here is tilted. If this is the axis of propagation, it's a little bit tilted. Or you can have that the axis is not quite in the center of the mirror. Or you can have that the tilt and the centering is okay, but you see, the curvature is wrong. The divergence of the beam is not quite large enough, which means that here, the curvature of the beam is almost flat while it should match the mirror. Or you can have something that just have the wrong side. The curvature is about right, but you see that the size here is just smaller than what you really need. So all those kind of things can happen. And they can happen statically in the sense that your beam, on average, has a mistake like that. And then we say that it's just tilted, or it's translated, or it's mismatched in this case, because it doesn't match the eigenmode. But it's something that can also be dynamical. The laser beams, they will jitter around. You know, if you have a pointer on your hand will tremble a little bit, and the laser beam will go there. Of course, our laser, I showed you a picture yesterday, it's pretty big, there's nobody holding it up, but it's still sitting on a table, sitting on ground, and the beam is steered by mirrors. The mirrors will vibrate a little bit. Meaning that you can have a contribution coming from jitter noise. And this trace here that I just highlighted is, for the Hanford detector, the contribution from laser beam jitter. So angular and translation motion and also beam size motion due mostly to vibration of the laser itself, due to the fact that the laser is a high power object that has to be cooled. And the way we cooled it was using water. And water can be a little bit turbulent. So that was inducing vibration. Some of those peaks here were due to mirrors on a periscope that is used to take the beam from the level of the laser lab to the level of the main interferometer. So this is what we had during O2. You might ask, why didn't you fix that? Well, at that point, it was a matter of, do we want to go into the laboratory and change stuff with a big risk? Because when you put your hand on the laser, you know, if you lose the laser, you're done. So this is a high risk. And then we decided that the risk was too high for the payoff. We could have improved the sensitivity, but it wasn't not worth the time, the downtime, and the risk. So this is something that we have solved after O2, after the last science run. During the stop, we changed the laser, we changed the cooling system, we changed those mirrors, we made this periscope more sturdy. So we believe that this will not be a problem anymore, and we will soon find out. Well, another big issue, yes?
What did you change the cooling system to?
So the laser was changed. So yes, the cooling system is different. So
but it's still water cooled.
It's still water cooler because this guy produced 70 watts. The efficiency is 30%, which is pretty high. But this means that there is about, you know, 200 watts going around there. And you should try to air cool 200 watts out of a box this big. I don't know if you guys are into overclocking your computers for gaming, but when you get to some point, everybody puts water cooling. And the power there is lower than what we have here. Okay. And also, if your computer fries, well, okay, it's a big issue for you. If this laser fries, I mean, add a few zeros to the cost of your computer.
I was curious if there was some more advanced cooling techniques that like I had never heard of, like laser cooling or something.
So,
laser
cooling of a laser, that's quite interesting. We should think. Then you have to cool the other laser. Now, please, let's not go down that road. This is a slippery slope. You don't want to go there. No, I mean, the best you can do for that amount of power is still water cooling. So that's the thing. So, another big source of noise that was really a big limitation in the first generation detector is scatter light. So let me explain what this is. In the ideal case, you have your beautiful cavity with ideally perfect mirrors into a vacuum tube, right? And nothing bad happens. Well, this is not the ideal world. The mirrors are very well polished. The surface requirement and the smoothness is incredibly high, but still a part of the light will be scattered away. And the idea is that if this surface is a little bit rough, each part of that roughness behaves like a diffraction reticle. And so part of the light is scattered out. This means that the beam that comes in here, part of it is just scattered out. Let's say that a fraction, this is the E naught going in, and then a fraction F1 is scattered out. So this means that this beam here is something like F1 times the main beam. And that main beam is around 100 kilowatts. So there's a lot of power there. But this scattering is very, very small. Then this beam will go off and hit a piece of metal. This piece of metal, well, will scatter a lot. It's a piece of steel. So that will be scattering quite a lot. So it might happen that a fraction F2 of this will go and hit the other mirror. So again, we multiply by F2 here, right? And then part of this will also be scattered by the other mirror and will be multiplied by an F3 that we have here and will go exactly traveling along the length of the main beam. So that will be perfectly recombined to the main laser beam and completely indistinguishable from the main laser beam. So far, you might have two comments. First, well, but that scattering must be small. Yes, it is. But again, we're in the gravitational wave business. Nothing is small enough. The second point is that this spurious beam, what we call scatter beam or ghost beam sometimes, travels on a different path than the main beam. This means that the phase it accumulates is different. You get a different phase there. So at the end of the day, what you have into the cavity is your main beam plus some fraction of it, which can be very small, but then times a phase which changes over time. And this phase is random, because this phase depends on how much the vacuum tube moves there. And the vacuum tube is a piece of metal sitting on ground. It moves a lot. So this is quite a problem. And what happens, you know, I just rewrote everything like in terms of the amount of phase you accumulate there, L1, the amount of phase you accumulate there, L2, plus the various scattering factors. And you can, and this is what I just wrote, like the actual field you have inside is what you have in the ideal case, plus this small term. And this small term is something like that. So if you imagine to, you can take this exponential and write it in terms of cosine and sine, and you see something that looks like the main beam is now modulated. So this is very similar to what we discussed when we have modulation of the mirror. We're just adding some sidebands. So another way of seeing this scattering is that the fact that you have this spurious beam will add very small noise sidebands with a phase and an amplitude that depends on the motion of the scattering. So you are basically coupling somehow the motion of your vacuum tube into the main signal. It's even worse than that. It's even worse than that because our mirrors are moving not a lot. So you always assume that this Z is very small because everything is controlled. The distance never changes. But this is a piece of metal sitting on ground. That's going to move a lot and possibly many, many wavelengths. So this thing will take the motion and wrap it around 2 pi many, many times. So if, for example, you take something like this, let's imagine, this is a simulation, but let's imagine that the phase, the total displacement of that tube is of the order of 50 microns at very low frequency, which is not unreasonable. Ground will move that much without big problems. So if then you take this, and you remember that the thing that you actually, the amount of noise you have is something on the order like, for example, sine of cosine of k times z, where k is 2 pi over lambda times z. So, and these terms here is by no means between, you know, small, because every time you go 1 micron, this is basically 1 lambda. So every time you go 1 micron, this field will go through multiple fringes. So when you get up there, this guy went through 100 fringes. This means that the noise that you add is a highly nonlinear function of this motion. If you make a spectrum of that, what you see doesn't really look like that low frequency oscillation, but actually is a noise that looks kind of flat and goes to very, very high frequency. How's that possible? Well, what happens here is that if this thing is moving by 100 fringes, it means that every time you cross this 1 lambda, you're going through zero again. So even though this is moving very, very low, a very low frequency, actually your phase is rotating like crazy around, you know, 2 pi, 2 pi, 2 pi, 2 pi. So you get the maximum frequency, which is the number of times per second you cross lambda. And so if the motion was about 100 microns, you get something which is the order of 100 Hz. It's even more interesting to look at this in a spectrogram. So this is a time and frequency representation. So basically, I'm taking a Fourier transform of my noise at each time. And you see that the noise is not at all flat. What I was showing earlier is just an average along this direction. What happens here is that you see that the noise is peaked at some position and go up and down in frequency. Well, this resembles exactly the velocity of your scatter. Actually, you can prove that this is directly proportional to the velocity. And indeed, this is a simulation, so things always much better in simulation, of course. But we were able to find that even in reality. The red curve now is just a trace properly rescaled of the velocity, of the absolute value of the velocity of the scattering object. So if you have some scattered light that hits some part that moves a lot, that's the kind of noise you get. And this is something which is very hard to trace because it's a very highly nonlinear function of the motion of the objects there. And then on top of that, it's hard to track where your beam is scattering. If it's something in the center of the beam tube, then what do? You cannot put a seismometer right there. If you know the point, you can do that. So let me show some real data. So during first generation detector. So these are two examples from Virgo, just because I managed to find them. So this is a subpoint when there was a motion of the beam splitter mirror, which was out of control, and there was a spurious beam reflected by the beam splitter and hitting the wrong surfaces. And you see in red the prediction from the motion of that mirror, and you see in black the actual noise that we measure. And you see this strange behavior. The beam splitter was moving a very low frequency, you know, few hertz. Nevertheless, the fact that what you see in your detector is the sine of the cosine of 2 pi over lambda times the motion gives you a huge up conversion. You know, you cannot even expand in polynomials because you have to keep all of them, because here the guy was moving at a few hertz and still we got a noise up to some hundreds of hertz. And another example here that shows you how the Virgo sensitivity was in bad weather and in good weather. So good weather is the blue trace and bad weather is this red trace. What was happening there is that some of the light that was transmitted through the end mirrors at the end of the arm was hitting some wrong place. It doesn't really matter what it was, and some of that was reflected back. When there was bad weather, which means a lot of wind, the building was shaking more, and that piece of the chamber that was scattering was moving more. And so we could see at that time a different motion depending on the weather. And then this purple curve is just what you reconstruct by just putting a seismometer right there where that beam was hitting and measuring the fact that it was moving more or less. In good weather, you get this cyan curve that you can probably barely see down there. And in bad weather, you get this pink curve, which matched quite well what you measured. So that was a big problem in the first generation detector. That's why we put a lot of effort in that. So from the beginning, the second generation advanced detector were designed with a lot of what we call buffers. And buffers are basically pieces of glass metal that absorb very well infrared light. And the idea is that every surface that is not the mirror must be covered by something like that. Meaning that if I am on the mirror and I'm putting my face right where the mirror is and I'm looking down the tube from any mirror, I'm looking at interferometer, all I see is either another mirror or black glass or absorbing glass or buffers. We did our best to include those in the design of advanced LIGO. Still, it was not enough. When you installed that, we were running, and we think that part of the low frequency noise that was limiting advanced LIGO during the O1 and O2 run were due to some scattered light. This is why during this year-long break between O2 and O3, we went into the vacuum and installed probably 300 more pieces of glass or metal. You know, use glass when the laser power is low. You cannot use glass when the laser power is high, because glass has a very low thermal conductivity. So if you have a lot of power, it's going to heat up locally and break. So that's not good. So you can use silicon carbide, you can use silicon, you can just use, you know, coated stainless steel, different materials that absorb the light. So we did a lot of that. Things are much better now. Again, we will see very soon if that will pay off for that noise and low frequency that we did not quite understand. So this is by no means an extensive list of all the possible technical noise or issues that you get, but I just wanted to give you an idea of some of those that are more amenable to a description like that. So let me now move to what is the current status. So these two plots shows you the two science runs that we had with advanced LIGO. So this is time in weeks, and the y-axis show the average range for a binary neutron star coalescence. So if you assume a 1.4 solar masses binary neutron system, this shows you what is the maximum distance at which we could detect that with an SNR of 8. And since the detector sensitivity is not uniform across the sky, this is just assuming an average along across all the sky. So you can see that during O1, the two detectors, so the red was Hanford and the green was Livingston, had both a sensitivity around 60 to 80 megaparsecs, kind of stable over time. This is the O2 run. So again, it's a little bit longer, 38 weeks or something like that. And you can see that the Livingston detector was significantly improved. So like 90 or even 100. The Hanford detector, unfortunately, started at a level which was pretty much comparable with what we had before. And then here you see a big drop. What happens there is that there was an earthquake in Montana, small earthquake. But Montana is pretty close to Washington State, where Hanford is. So this shook the mirror, and one of the end mirror actually bumped into some protection. So this protection are made of PEEK, which is a kind of plastic. What happened is that the rubbing between the glass and the plastic charged slightly the glass. And there you have some charges of the mirror, and that charge will couple with some of the stray electric field in the ambient. Again, there's a lot of electromagnetic field in normal environment. The electric field, you know, really volt over meter, is pretty small at frequencies of 100 Hz, but still there is something there. Then, of course, at that point, you have to decide, what do we do? Do we open the chamber and try to discharge that? Because, honestly, how do you discharge a piece of glass which is almost impossible to see in vacuum into a vacuum chamber? Not easy to do that. We have techniques, but they're kind of risky. So we already knew that we had only a few more, you know, a month more, 2 months more of runs. So we said, well, you know, okay, let's wait and clean up everything afterwards. But these are the kind of things that happen. And then, was it a good idea to have that earthquake safety stopper made of plastic, of PEEK instead of other material? Well, it sounded like a good idea because plastic is better than a piece of metal if you hit the mirror. Probably not, but yeah, this is the kind of things that you learn as you go. Still, this was enough to detect plenty of signals, so we cannot complain too much, right? So the goal now is that we're going into O3. So after the end of O2, which was more than a year ago, we literally opened all the possible vacuum chambers and we did a lot of different improvements. I just listed a few here. New test mass mirrors to reduce the scattering of light. There was a known defect on the uniformity of the coatings on the mirror, so we changed them to better mirror more uniform. There will be less scattered light. Something that I didn't quite mention, but the mirrors, you have the main mirrors here, and on the back there is another piece of fused silica, which is just used as a reaction mass to apply a force to the mirror. Because the point is that if you want to apply a force to the mirror, and you cannot have something that really touches and pushes it. So the way we do that is using some electrostatic actuation. But then the electrostatic actuation will apply a force with respect to another object. If that other object is moving, then your actuation authority, the amount of force you apply, changes over time. So you want to apply a force for another object which is just suspended to the same level of isolation as the main mirror. So this is why we have a main chain and a reaction chain. But then what happens is that those two big chunk of glasses must be very close one to the other. But then you can have some gas trapped into there because pumping out gas is hard. And those molecules will still move randomly, and that random a collision of the molecules between the two mirrors will give us what we call residual gas noise, which is small, but not that small. So what we decided to do is to just carve a big hole in the center of this reaction mass and make it shape like a donut. And this way, there's less gas trapped there. This is one thing that we had. We didn't think about that at the beginning. We found that with doing some computation that could have been a problem quite soon. So instead of waiting to see it and then solve it, we decided to solve it. Then what I already told you, we have new lasers. Then we are going to implement squeezing. So remember this morning I discussed just injection of squeezed state to improve quantum noise. And we're going to do that, what is called frequency-independent squeezing, just to reduce the shot noise at all frequencies. The problem is that if you reduce the shot noise, you remember, you are reducing the uncertainty in your vacuum state in one direction, but you're increasing the other direction. Turns out that the other direction is what matters for radiation pressure. If you remember the two phases of the fluctuation, where the phase and the intensity, the amplitude, and the radiation pressure depends on the fluctuation of the power. So when we reduce the quantum noise in one direction to improve the shot noise at high frequency, so to improve our phase sensitivity, we're actually increasing the quantum fluctuation in the intensity of the laser beam, meaning that the quantum radiation pressure will go up, which is not a problem for advanced LIGO because we have a lot of margin there. I will say in a couple of slides that will be a problem for future detectors. That's why we're gonna find tricks to solve that. Then I already told you that we install buffers to catch scatter light everywhere. And then the Hanford detector is fully operative as of 3 days ago. So we have to, you know, go through that long procedure to make it work again after all those intervention. And hopefully we'll have a lot of noise studies, not a lot of noise improvement. So the goal is to start sometimes next year, beginning of next year, unclear when, because the goal is to have both detectors up and running with a sensitivity of the order of 120 megaparsecs. So it means basically going about, I don't know, order of 30% more range than what we did during the last run. But 30% or more distance means basically 30% cubed, which is about the double volume of the universe. So the rate will be at least doubled. So instead of seeing an event every month, more or less, which is what we saw, we could see much more, so like one every couple of weeks, which will add a lot to the astrophysic reach of the detectors. So this is all I wanted to say about the current state. So the message is stay tuned, because there will be for sure new black holes, new neutron stars, and hopefully some new universe will gift us something else out there. Then, of course, the fact that we are improving O3, there's already an O4 planned for advanced LIGO, doesn't mean that advanced LIGO is the end of the story. We just started gravitational wave astronomy. We just started that. So we are already thinking how to improve further the sensitivity of the detectors beyond the limitation due to this current design, and even how to go to what we call the third generation detectors. So on the near term, we have what is called Advanced LIGO Plus. I know this is not the fanciest name or the most catchy name, but at the end of the day, we are physicists. The fantasy has there's a limit. So if we go back to this graph here, which is again the Advanced LIGO design sensitivity, you remember we already discussed that the two main limitations is quantum noise and coarsening thermal noise. So what we need to do is to improve those two. Well, to improve quantum noise, what we need to do is to do some sort of squeezing. And to improve coarsening thermal noise, well, we have to improve the materials the coatings are made of. Our goal is to go from this total black curve, which is the advanced LIGO design, to this thick curve, which is the advanced LIGO plus design. And you see that it's almost a factor two of improvement at all frequencies. A factor two of improvement at all frequency means that the range for whatever signal will be double, which means that we expect order of 8 times more event. So a factor two might seem a little bit, not something you want to put a lot of money on that, but 8 times more events, meaning that if these detectors will work, we're going to see something at the order of black hole a day or something like that. So at this point, my data analysis friend are already freaking out. They'll say, we cannot keep up with that number of signal. But they have still some time to improve that. So how are we going to do this? Well, for quantum noise, we already discussed this morning that we can inject squeezed vacuum from the input for the output part of the detector. If we squeeze in the right phase, we can improve the shot noise. So we can improve this part here, which is shot noise. But this part here is radiation pressure noise. So I already explained to you that if you squeeze in one direction to improve shot noise, it means that we are actually anti-squeezing the other direction and increasing the radiation pressure. So what we would really like is to have a vacuum field which is squeezed in one direction at high frequency and squeezed in the other direction at low frequency. So if we put frequency here and then I represent my squeezing, so we would like to have at high frequency something which is like this, but then at low frequency we would like something which is like this. Because at low frequency we are not limited by shot noise, but we are limited by radiation pressure noise, which depends on the size of your uncertainty in ellipse in the other direction. And then of course this means that you have to do something like that. You have to rotate your squeezing angle. So this is what is called frequency dependent squeezing. Well, it turns out that it's hard to do that, but it's not too hard. And the way you can do this is just to send your vacuum field into a cavity. If you remember, we discussed the very first lecture that when you reflect a field, a classical field, off a cavity, the phase of the reflected field gets rotated. And when you get from resonance to anti-resonance, the rotation can be 90 degrees or 180 degrees, depending on how you tune your cavity. But here you want to rotate the quantum field. But what we said this morning is that a quantum field behaves pretty much like a classical field. So you can have your quantum vacuum, have it reflected off a filter cavity, which is tuned to the right position. And if you tune to the proper resonance, this filter cavity, then you can keep just the angle of the squeezing as you like at high frequency, and then make sure that as the frequency of the field goes towards zero, you are crossing from, for example, from resonance to anti-resonance, or the other way around, and then you rotate the angle. So this is something that has been proven to work experimentally in the lab on a meter-long cavities, and we are planning to implement this kind of frequency-dependent squeezing on advanced LIGO Plus. This is not in the far future. This is 2020 or something like that, 2022, something like this. So we already have we have already been funded to build this, and we prove that we are able to build this. So this is a way that then the quantum noise will be lowered all along the frequency spectrum. Of course, the other point here is thermal noise. There's not much point in reducing the quantum noise if you're not able to reduce thermal noise. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but if you remember, we discussed this morning that the way we build our coatings is with multiple stacks of materials. And the limitation in thermal noise is due to the fact that there is a lot of friction in those materials, especially the titanium doptantala. So what we need to do is to find a way to make better materials that have lower frictions. And by the way, this is one of my main responsibilities at Caltech. So I'm running one of the laboratories that are trying to do this kind of R&D. So the idea is that people found out that depending on how you build glasses, because those materials are amorphous. They're amorphous materials, so it's a form of glass. And it's very easy to study what happens in a crystal. It's very hard to study the behavior of amorphous materials like glasses. And we don't know much about glasses. Turns out that depending on how you produce the glass, for example, how fast you cool it down, or how fast you deposit it, or what temperature you deposit your coating, you can get different results. For example, people found out that by depositing amorphous silicon, so it's not silicon dioxide, just silicon, but you can deposit that as amorphous material, like a glassy silicon. Depending on the way you deposit it, you can really improve the loss angles of the internal friction by the orders of magnitude. So there's hope that at least for some materials, we know ways to do that. So we are actively working, trying to find procedure to have a better and lower mechanical frictions. I think you are all too tired for me to go into this thing, so let's keep it. Well, this is what is gonna happen in the next 5 to 6 years. What about the far future? Well, there are two directions here. One is just say, hey, we have the current facilities, which are basically 4 kilometers long vacuum tubes. How much can you squeeze out of that? And this is what is called LIGO Voyager. A little bit more catchy name, still, you can like it or not. So, but this will start with the advanced LIGO detector here. Then you see the advanced LIGO Plus detector, and the low frequency curve here is a little bit different from what I showed earlier, because this was not really including a lot of frequency independent squeezing. So it's a kind of an old curve. So the goal is to go with Voyager to what we think is the best possible, which is this black curve. And the way you have to go down with quantum noise and go even down with the coatings. The way to do that is to go cryogenic. So one way to reduce thermal noise is just to reduce the temperature. Unfortunately, if you take a piece of fused silica and you reduce the temperature, it turns out that the mechanical friction into that particular glass gets way, way worse at the room temperature. So if we were to cool down the LIGO mirrors like now, we would lose. We get an even higher thermal noise. So what we need to do is to change material. Well, we need big mirrors because we want to make them even bigger. So the bigger the mirror, the bigger the mass, and the lower radiation pressure noise you have, because the fluctuation will be the same, the amount of momentum transferred by the laser will be the same, but you have more mass if everything scales with the mass. So we want something of the order of 200 kilograms, so we need very big mirrors. Well, the only other material that people are able to produce with high purity is silicon, crystalline silicon, because that's used in semiconductor industry. And they have no problem going to 40 centimeters or more. And then silicon has also the very nice property that if you cool it down at low temperature, it behaves very well. Actually, if you cool it down at 123 Kelvin, which is not super cold, it has the very nice properties that the thermal expansion crosses zero. But if the thermal expansion crosses zero, it means that thermal fluctuations will couple only quadratically to your displacement. So you win a lot of thermal noise there because you have a zero crossing the thermal expansion. Sounds good. 120 Kelvin is cryogenic, but it's not crazy cryogenic. It's not too hard to do that, right? You can even do that with pulse tubes or stuff like that if you want. We prefer some passive coolant, of course. The problem is that if you've ever seen a piece of silicon, it doesn't look transparent at all. It doesn't look transparent even in the infrared. So our 1,064 nanometers wavelength laser doesn't work anymore. And the reason is that the band gap in the semiconductor is right there, and so you are basically absorbing everything at that frequency. So what you need to do is to change the laser frequency. Go, for example, to 1.5 or 2 microns. Well, okay, so this means that Voyager is basically it. Higher power laser, different wavelength laser. By the way, we don't have high power 2 micron laser yet, but we're working on that. And then you use silicon mirrors, cool down 123 Kelvin, much larger masses, and of course, frequency-dependent squeezing, because at that time, we believed that advanced LIGO Plus would have already demonstrated that that frequency-dependent squeezing is just a piece of cake, so there's no problem. That's something that, yeah, we're gonna do that. It's just plug and play. But you know, this will basically push the limit of the facilities that we have right now. It's hard to believe that we will be able to squeeze more out of this detector. But if we go back to the sensitivity, you see that we are thinking of something, especially here, where you know a lot of the physics happens for binary black holes and systems like that, we're already going almost a factor of 10 or something other than a factor of 10 more than advanced LIGO. Not quite everywhere, but it's a significant amount of sensitivity. This is a kind of instrument that's gonna detect multiple black holes a day, probably. So, again, data analysts are running away screaming like crazy. Yes.
Why the violet line across the no?
Oh, sorry.
Why do you have a odd eye frequency? Yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
So that's a trade-off on the amount of power you have into your detector and the finesse of the resonant cavity. So if you want to gain a lot there, you can sacrifice a little bit there. Of course, it depends on what you like. So if you like, for example, just to look at the spiral of black holes, you care what happens there. Nothing goes above a few hundred hertz. If you care about the spiral of neutron stars, then you go up to 1.2, 1.3 kilohertz, which is the innermost stable orbit that Chad was discussing this morning or yesterday. But if you want to see some modes on the neutron star that happens or supernovae, then you do care what happens at very high frequency. So people looking for supernovae might not be happy with that. But it's a trade-off. So those are all sensitivity on paper, even more than advanced LIGO 1. So it's possible that if we discover that there's a lot of sensitivity at 3 kilohertz, we will find out a way to improve the sensitivity there. That's, those are very preliminary, so just take them with a grain of salt, of course. Well, then what beyond that? You know, this would be the version 2.5 of those detectors, and pretty much all you can squeeze out of the current facilities. So at some point, you would like to really go for a completely brand new third generation detector. So let's say we want to build a completely new facility somewhere else. What can we do? How can we improve the sensitivity? Here there are two different approaches. One is the one that is called Cosmic Explorer, which is mostly a LIGO collaboration effort. And the other one is called the Einstein Telescope, which is mostly a European collaboration. They have two different approaches. The approach here is to say, well, at the time we're going to start building this, we will have already be at the Voyager level. So we basically get the best we can get out of 4 kilometers. How can we get it better? Well, you make it bigger. That always works, right? If 4 kilometers works, if you use almost exactly the same technology and you make it 40 kilometers instead of 4 kilometers, you gain basically a factor of 10, sorry. So now, just to put you in perspective, a 40 kilometers long interferometer, 40 kilometers is a lot. is really big. I mean, if you will ever come to the Hanford site, let me know. I'm gonna give you a tour, and we can walk the 4 kilometers or run the 4 kilometers to the end station. It's gonna take a bit. So 40 kilometers is just huge, and people literally are spending their time writing scripts in Google Maps to place big 40 by 40 L's in the maps around the United States and try to find places where you can fit them. And believe me, there aren't many. Nevada and Utah are places where you could build that. There's a lot of empty space there. But yeah, but that's basically the idea.
How about Canada?
Hey, just suggesting it. Why not? Yeah.
I think you mentioned you might want it to be underground. Though.
Yes, so would be nice to be underground. If you are underground, you win at low frequency of the seismic noise. So in this case, what people would love to have is a big mountain here, 40 kilometers, another big mountain, and exactly 90 degrees, 40 kilometers, another big mountain. Because in this case, you just have to dig a few tunnels here, a few tunnels there, because what matters is just that the mirrors are underground. Nobody cares what happens along the arm. But digging a 40 kilometers long tunnel underground, nobody is thinking about that, because that is about, is almost crazy. But I don't know if somebody found this kind of configuration. It's probably it's a little bit over-constrained, I guess. But this will be a surface detector. There is no underground here. Instead, if you look into the Einstein telescope, and you can tell that they've been working a lot more on that because they have very fancy view graphs. So their idea is to go in a somewhat orthogonal direction. So instead of going just longer and rely on technologies that are pretty much already, that at that time will be ready, it's gonna be only 10 kilometers long. Only 10 kilometers long. But then underground and with a triangular shape. And the idea is that if you have a triangular shape, you lose a little bit because the best sensitivity is with that. But then if you go to 60 degrees and you dig another tunnel, you can fit 3 interferometers in the same tunnels. So why not? Instead of building it longer, you just build it more of them. And then it's even more complicated than that, because their idea is to have each of the three corners will have 2 interferometers. One at room temperature and one at low temperature. And the idea is that the one at room temperature will have high laser power and will give you a very good high frequency sensitivity because you have a lot of power. But if you have a mirror which is cooled down at 2 Kelvin or 10 Kelvin and you shine 5 megawatts of laser on it, even if that thing absorbs 1 part per million, you still have a lot of power to extract from something which is cooled at a few Kelvin and is just hanging in vacuum for two small fibers. So instead of having a high power interferometer cooled down, they said, why don't we have 2 interferometers co-located? One is high power by room temperature, so it has very bad low frequency sensitivity. The other one is just cryogenic, low power, so it's not a problem to cool it down. Well, it's not easy, but it's not completely insane to cool it down. But then, since the power is low, you don't gain any, you have a very bad sensitivity at high frequency. But if you have the two detectors co-located, then you can just merge the two output signal and get a xylophone configuration, as they call it, that combine the two. Yes?
Isn't it an option then for LIGO to co-locate in the same tunnel?
Yes, we could do that, yes. But we kind of think that having 2 interferometers like that sounds crazy. But we'll see. You know, the point is that all of those are at the design level. So we're going to see at the end of the day what we can really do. But this is, and then it's going to be underground. And that way you can really push to much lower frequency. If you see, this is 1 hertz. So they are just trying to shoot for having a very sensitive detector down to maybe, you know, even 5 hertz, even lower than that, which is going to be hard. Meaning that the suspension system, which is like the super attenuator that I showed in the Virgo case, they're going to be probably 30 or 40 meters tall with very long pendulum, very long inverted pendulum. In that case, they decided to take a design they already have and make it bigger. So, you know, depending of who are the experimenters that work in the design, you can get different approaches. Then before, yes?
How far underground when you talk about going underground?
Yeah, it's enough to go order of 100 meters or so,
okay.
Because most of the motion of the seismic motion are made by surface waves. If you go underground, then you don't have that much motion anymore. Of course, the more you go down and the lower you go, but at some point it doesn't pay off anymore. Because of course it's much harder to go.
Yeah.
The lower you go and the harder it is.
But it's more than like digging subway tunnels.
It's more than that, yes. That would not be enough. It's basically like digging subway tunnels just 100 meters down. So once you dig down and you get your big mole down, then you can dig. Probably not that easy. But people know, you know, people in mining operation have been doing this for decades. So it's not, technologically, there's nothing crazy to go there. It's just very expensive. Just very expensive. Well, before I wrap up a little bit earlier, so there's time for questions and that, there's another thing that's going to happen. So you can really go large. Yes?
For a minute, just curious, where's the place for Einstein Telescope?
So they haven't picked a place yet, and this is a European collaboration, and Europeans are very good at arguing with each other. So basically, almost every country in Europe wants it somewhere. So Italy is suggesting somewhere in Sardinia, which is the big island off the coast of Italy, which actually is a pretty nice place. The Dutch people are suggesting something near Maastricht, which is a nice place, but probably not as nice as the sea you get in Sardinia. Poland is also suggesting something like that in the north. It's really cold in the north there. So I don't know. At some point, they will pick one. Of course, ideally, you would like for the third generation to pick one common design and build as many as you can of those, because you still need multiple detectors to be able to do the kind of triangulation that Chad was describing earlier. But we're still, you know, those are 2030, 2035 horizons, so there's still some time to try to agree.
Could you not do the same triangulation with two different designs?
Yes,
okay.
Of course, yes. But it turns out that if the sensitivities are roughly equal, you have the most optimal results. If they are very different, of course, you can have something. So it doesn't help a lot to have, for example, advanced LIGO-style detector and a cosmic explorer detector with a factor 10 in different sensitivity. At that point, advanced LIGO will help only with very loud events, not with a smaller one. Oh, by the way, both Einstein Telescope and Cosmic Explorer, if they reach design sensitivity, they will be able to detect all stellar mass and, you know, up to 100, 200 solar masses, binary black holes, coalescence in the visible universe, all of them. So you go as far at that point that you don't detect them anymore that far just because you go back in time and there weren't black holes at that time. That's the idea. That's why it's called Cosmic Explorer, because at that point you see the entire visible universe. So there's nothing left out there. I think this is quite, I don't know how much it is in terms of redshift, but you know, at that point doesn't, of course it still makes sense to improve the sensitivity, because the sensitivity is not all about detecting more, but also if you improve the signal to noise ratio for the same signal, then you can get a better constraints on deviation from general relativity and things like that. So we believe that by the time we get here, we should have very good measurement of any possible deviation from general relativity. So any possible quantum gravity happening at the event horizon of those black holes, or we will have constrained very well the equation of state of nuclear matter in pulsars and in neutron stars, and all this kind of very interesting astrophysics. But then, before I close up, let me just spend a couple of words about LISA. So LISA stands for Laser Interferometer Space Antenna. And so the idea is that, you know, it's boring to stay on ground. Earth shakes so much, why don't we go in space? And then if you go in space, there's a lot of space out there, so why not we make it bigger? And so when you go to space, people always think big, and the idea here is that, yeah, well, let's make it an interferometer with an arm which is of the order of, I don't know, well, this one says 2.5 million kilometers. Originally it was 5, then it was 1, then it's 2.5 million kilometers. But still, order of 1 million kilometers. Well, of course, you cannot have that in orbit around Earth because there's just not that much orbit around Earth at that point. So you have to have it on an orbit which is kind of trailing Earth in a solar orbit, just some degrees behind or in front, I think behind, but I prefer it behind. So of course, the technology of this system is still an interferometer, but it's pretty different, because let's imagine, first you have to fly a laser. So you cannot fly a zillion watt laser up there. 1 watt is pretty much all you get. Then you have a laser beam, and you shine it, let's say, let's be optimistic, only 1 million kilometers far away. How many photons, you can do that as an exercise, how many photons out of a 1 watt laser are you gonna get there? You're gonna detect something on the order of micro or nanowatts, meaning that you cannot just put a mirror and reflect it back, because there's nothing to interfere with. So what happens is that you will have a big telescope there that will catch the residual laser, and then you phase lock that laser to another source there, and you send it to the other station, you send it back. And then you have to digitally measure the phase of the two lasers and reconstruct post facto. As part of your data analysis, you reconstruct the phase difference. And also the arms, you cannot have orbits, you cannot put a triangular shape in orbit and assume that the distance will stay the same within a millimeter or so. It will change by thousands of kilometers. So again, you have to be able to track that change in distance and cancel it out from your data. This whole technique is called time delay interferometry. Basically, you measure the time of flight of the laser from one spacecraft to the other one for each of the spacecrafts, and then you can produce a smart combination of the time of flight, factor out the motion, the orbital motion that you know, and you still can get to a quite remarkable sensitivity. The point is that this thing is so big, it will be sensitive to very, very low frequencies. So this is the expected sensitivity of LISA, and those are 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 1, 1 hertz. So if all the ground detector will be sensitive to stuff as low as 10 hertz, 5 hertz, if you believe in the Einstein telescope design, LISA will be sensitive to 0.1 millihertz to maybe some 10 millihertz or more. So a completely different kind of sources, which means that this will be sensitive to supermassive black holes with the masses of in the 10,000, 100,000, or million solar masses. So it's a different kind of physics. There's even something that I found really interesting about LISA is that it will still be able to measure binary black holes with something on the order of 20 to 100 solar masses, but when they are still very far away, so when they're still orbiting at, you know, order of 100 seconds or 50 seconds per orbit. But those are possible LIGO sources. They will at some point coalesce and be sensitive to LIGO. But they will be able to track them during all their evolution. So the LISA mission will have a 5-year time span. They will see these two black holes getting closer and closer and closer. You track them for about a year. You can predict very well all the parameters, where they are in the sky. They pick up the phone and call LIGO and say, hey, LIGO, on September 13, 2043, at 10:03 a.m., plus or minus some minutes, because we know we were lazy, we didn't really want to do all the math, you will have a binary black hole. Please be online, no pressure. So, I mean, jokes apart, this is gonna be an exciting thing. So the good news is that this has been approved to be launched by the European Space Agency in 2034. There is hope if NASA gets into it again to be able to launch it earlier than that. Space missions, you know, people have been designing this since the 80s, so I don't know, it's gonna be 60 years to launch it. It's not too bad for a space mission. People have spent the whole career, they started as grad students working on design on this, and they're gonna retire way before it's been launched. That's why I prefer stuff on ground, especially if something of that doesn't work, there's no way you have to go there and fix it. Yes.
You also expect to see many, many binaries there.
Yes.
Right? So it's gonna be a hell to, I mean, you can underscore.
Yeah, so yeah, of course. But the funny thing is that they, so this is the, let's say, the instrument noise background. If you read some of those papers, you will see that they have some kind of bump on top of that, and that's the background due to the confusion noise in gravitational waves of all the binary system in the nearby universe. And that will give, it's something that there are so many that you cannot resolve all of them. And so that is a noise in the sense, it's a background in the sense that it will limit your sensitivity to one particular signal. They still have astrophysical origin. So it's like, you know, background in particle physics. They're not quite sure how they're going to handle that. But I mean, when we get there, when we cross that bridge, we'll find out how to do that. But this is a very interesting mission. And by the way, recently the LISA Pathfinder mission flew and demonstrated that all this part of the sensitivity down here is feasible, because the technology is there. So this is something that when it flies, it's gonna work. So this is gonna be amazing. We just have to wait.
Yeah.
Yes.
So when LISA looks like the frequency band like 10 to 82, and LIGO is good for something like 10.
Yes.
People have the plenty in between that.
Yeah. Yes, of course. I don't have time to show that, but there's plenty of you know, there's a big gap of things like in that. So there are two ways to do that. One is to try to stay on ground and try to build better seismic isolation or systems that are less sensitive to seismic isolation. One way to seismic motion, sorry. One way is to use torsion bars. So you have two bars like that with a torsion joint in the middle. And so then gravitational waves will give you some sort of strain like that. And you can isolate this kind of system much better with respect to seismic motion. Another way is to go in space, but go in Earth orbit, and just make it small. You know, if you build a 10 kilometers long in Earth orbit, you can access frequencies that are in between. Or there is this the DESIGO mission, which is another space antenna, which is, I think, 1,000 kilometers, but don't quote me on that. I think it's an order of 1,000 kilometers. 1,000 kilometers is too big to be in Earth orbit, so it's going to be, again, somewhere here. It's going to be a very crowded space, and that's going to be sensitive in an overlap of the two regions.
Are they supposed to be orbiting a Lagrange point?
No, the point is that they will have orbits around the sun with a little bit of inclination. So actually, if you Google LISA orbits, there's a very nice animation. That triangle is basically rotating over time. So it's kind of a, you know, in 3D you have the sun here, this is the Earth orbit, and the triangle is put like that. So it rotates like this as it goes around, because that's the only way to have orbits that get as close as possible to remain at equal distance. Well, this is all I have. I just want to close up with a last slide. All those slides should be by the end of the day online, because I gave them to the organizer. So this is just some general references. You have my contact information. Feel free to ask me any question. And if you happen to be in the Eastern Washington State, I have no idea why you should happen to be there. But if that happens, let me know. I'll be happy to show you around interferometer. One last thing. At this web address, you found some notes. Those are not really notes about these classes, but they are a very preliminary stage of a set of notes on these topics. So you can go there, download them. They're very rough. It's a very first stage, so you'll find a lot of mistakes, typos, and issues. And they cover pretty much all of lecture one, one-third of lecture two, and none of lecture three, but I'm working on them. So if you go there from time to time, you'll find that there is more or less. So feel free to go there, take a look, and if you really don't know how to waste your time, read them and send me back comments and questions and ideas. Yes?
Where does pulsar timing arrays fit into that picture?
So,
are they just going to be obsolete now?
No, because in this frequency scale, they're somewhere like here. So they're talking about nanohertz.
Oh.
So there's something different. So they're going to be sensitive to completely different sources. Like, for example, a cosmological background that have very low frequencies, or super, super, super massive black holes. I don't even know how big they are at this point. But it's a very different frequency band. Then, of course, really, I know that you're going to ask the question, no, nobody's thinking how to fill between, you know, 0.01 millihertz to nanohertz. I don't know how we're going to do that. But pulsar timing array is a very interesting technique. I don't know much about that. The only thing they need is just to integrate for a very long time. So they've been integrating 20 years or so. I guess they're every year they say we're basically 1 year away from having a good sensitivity. We'll see how we get there. But surely, if there are gravitational waves of that low frequency, which is not obvious, well, it's obvious that there are. It's not obvious how big they are, how weak they are. They will definitely see them. Yes?
How about going the other way? Because we talked about squeeze states
yes,
helping, but is there
yes.
idea of like,
so,
is there anything to detect there?
There is not a lot going on to push the frequency up, mostly because from the astrophysical point of view, we expect that a lot of the juice is at the low frequency. Because the higher the mass and the lower you're going frequency, the lowest possible mass you can use to generate something which, I mean, a significant amount of a gravitational wave is about a solar mass. And this gives you something, in the best case, in the kilohertz. Of course, there are models, for example, of cosmic background from inflation. Some of the models predict gravitational waves at higher frequencies. So there are some proposals to go in the many hundreds of kilohertz and megahertz range. I don't know of any project really going on right now. The easy thing about, well, nothing is easy, but the point is that you don't need and you cannot go big if you go higher frequency. Because if your length is that much, but if the time of travel of your light or the duration of your measurement is comparable with the period of the gravitational wave, then you start averaging over multiple periods and you start losing sensitivity because you're averaging a sinusoid over a long time. And you lose like 1/T basically after a while. So if you go to megahertz, it's an out of a meter scale. So they should be easier to build. There's basically no seismic noise at the megahertz, but then at the megahertz, you have all the electromagnetic noise on Earth, which is also very hard to shield. So there are trade-offs. I'm not aware of any project going on to go at that frequency, and the main reason that I believe, as far as I know, there's not a lot of astrophysical push to go there.
In the sense that there's no sources, you mean?
There's no solid prediction of sources that would give anything up there. Because, you know, you can imagine if you have binary system that will be so light that you remember that the frequency increases with the inverse of the mass, so the lightest, the higher the frequency, but also the amplitude of the gravitational waves goes down with the mass. So if they're very light, they emit the gravitational waves, but very low amplitude. And so it's easy to, you know, to get below any reasonable sensitivity. I know that people suggested using either electromagnetic cavities or Bose-Einstein condensates as you know, displaced, basically as resonators at the end of the day. But I honestly, I don't know much about all of this because we are busy enough in the audio band. Yes.
But if you want to detect the post-merger, for example, of two neutron stars, shouldn't you go up in this region?
Yes, but that's still in the few kilohertz. So we will still be able, you know, if you go to, I don't have any plot here, but that's something that I should have prepared. But if, for example, you have a cosmic explorer-like sensitivity, the typical post-merger of a neutron star will be somewhere here, and you will have a signal-to-noise ratio of 100 or something like that. Because the actual prediction, it depends on the equation of state. But the actual prediction is that with the advanced LIGO design sensitivity, which we are not quite there yet, we are almost there, the signal-to-noise ratio of the post-merger will be a few, 1, 2, 3, depends on the model. So once you get a factor 10 or more better than that, then the SNR will go up a lot. So for that, it should be enough to have this kind of ground-based detectors. And of course, my hope is always that nature will give us some new sources that we didn't expect that will push our experiment in a different direction, because that's always the best thing you can do. You design for something, you discover something that was unexpected, and then experimentalists like me have to go down and design all new experiment, which is fun. Any more questions? I guess we are all very tired. Well, I want to thank you all for bearing with me this long, and I hope you enjoyed those lectures. Thank you.